Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site hcplive.com. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our topic and our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association hcplive.com homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Today's topic strays away from our usual respiratory focus to address a broader topic that spans the healthcare industry. And that is the importance of resiliency and sustainability in the healthcare industry. In these days of extreme weather events and resultant floods and wildfires, not to mention the consequences of epidemics such as the recent COVID-19 pandemic, the nation's healthcare industry is at the front line of helping our citizens maintain their health. In the healthcare industry, resilience is the capacity of individuals, organizations, or systems to adapt and thrive in the face of these challenges, stresses, and disruptions, while maintaining high-quality care. It involves preparing for, absorbing, and recovering from, and adapting to various stressors. In the healthcare industry, sustainability focuses on creating and maintaining systems that improve, maintain, or restore health while minimizing negative environmental impacts and promoting the health and well-being of both current and future generations. Both resilience and sustainability in the healthcare industry are significant topics on their own. Today, we can only hope to raise our listeners' awareness of these topics to improve their understanding of today's reality in the industry. Our guest today is well-suited to give us an introduction to this topic. Dr. Elizabeth Trucheo is Professor of Medicine and Director of Climate Health at the Cooper Medical School of Rowan University in New Jersey. She is co-chair for Physician Engagement and Women in Medicine and serves as the Associate Program Director for the Internal Medicine Residency. In this role, she develops novel curricula, including comprehensive research, advocacy, and climate health curricula. She is the chair of a climate health task force for the Medical Society of New Jersey and chair of the Health and Public Policy for the American College of Physicians, New Jersey chapter, in which role she has been advocating for sustainability efforts for healthcare systems by creating a task force for healthcare sustainability in the Medical Society. She is the chair of Climate Health Task Force for the Medical Society of New Jersey and chair of the Health and Public Policy for the American College of Physicians New Jersey chapter, in which role she has been advocating for sustainability efforts for healthcare systems by creating a task force for healthcare sustainability. In the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, she co-chairs two committees, one on education and one on climate smart healthcare. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction.
You're welcome. So let's start out with resilience. As I mentioned, I have heard this topic broken down into the individual, the organizational or hospital or clinic, and the broader system, which includes the hospitals along with public health agencies. Do you think it's a good way to discuss this? And what would be some of the factors contributing to resilience in these sectors of healthcare?
So, you know, I think there's been more and more in the news and in common conversation about what resilience means for hospitals. People often partition it into the resilience piece and the sustainability piece. And for those of us who are deeply embedded in this work, we see it as two sides of the same coin, really. But resilience means that you can keep your doors open and you can keep on treating patients, which we all want to do when there's a climate disaster, or even if you think about it more broadly, because resilience also has to do with workforce. If there are pandemics, if there are other disasters that maybe are not even climate driven. So that resilience kind of also comes in a couple flavors. It's the infrastructure. It's, you know, are your buildings constructed in a way that it can weather that 100-year storm? or that it can sustain the winds that are going to be coming in the next 3 or 4 decades. But then it's also some of the softer infrastructure. Can you mobilize? Do you have the supply chain resilience, or do you only have that just-in-time 3 days supply chain that so many health systems right now have? Do you have the person power? You know, we saw when there are events like in Lahaina or in with Tropical Storm Helene in North Carolina, healthcare professionals are often dealing with their own disasters. And so how do you mobilize people who are already dealing with their own personal disasters to care for the injured and the sick? And so all of this has to be thought of and really approached in a very deep way before a disaster happens. And that means not just keeping those conversations within the four walls of your institution, but branching out and talking to community organizations, talking to local and state government, and even regional consortia, because it's, you know, it really is something that, as you can imagine, there's so many levels of complexity. So yes, that resilience does have to do with the buildings and with talking with engineers and architects in advance, but there's so much more to it than that. And it really is worthwhile putting in the effort up front. You know, there have been some estimates because it, you know, I know that all health systems, not just now, but you know, for years, many are operating on shoestring budgets. But there really is an economic argument to a lot of this. There are some estimates that hospital damages from extreme weather can range from about $600,000 up to $2 billion. And the World Health Organization actually estimates that for retrofitting, you could invest as little as 1% of the value of the hospital and possibly protecting up to 90% of a hospital's assets. So it really is important from an investment perspective to think about resilience in that lens as well.
I'm struck by what you said with regard to, I mean, did the COVID-19 pandemic teach us anything? We saw burnout, we saw, you know, beds not being available, ventilators, a lot of the supply chain you mentioned. What do you see as a learning from that? And if we have learned, are we continuing to listen to our learnings?
Oh, that's a good question. There were a lot of lessons that I think many of us pulled out, some having to do with supply chain resilience, some having to do with how we can decrease some of our use so that we're not wasting some of this, you know, like a Lean Six Sigma methodology, doing, you know, making sure that we're utilizing the resources that we have and that we're also pulling on assets from the local community, even thinking about how we can partner with other hospitals and other health systems to share resources. One way that we kind of backtracked a little bit, though, has to do with PPE. So, you know, that the personal protective equipment is now everywhere. There's a lot of efforts in, it started, I believe, in the UK, but it's that there's global efforts with gloves off campaigns, because now people are putting gloves on for everything. When I go to the grocery store, people have gloves on, and it's just like, ah. And so if you talk to hand hygiene experts, they will tell you that it doesn't help hand hygiene, because when people put on those gloves, they're not sanitizing their hands. They're not cleaning them. And so it's actually worse for patients. And we're using so many resources. It's very costly. And of course, all of those are ending up in landfills. And the rubber has to come from somewhere. So there are rubber plantations where, you know, this has to be churned out from. So that's just one example where, you know, we maybe could have learned some lessons, but then we also took a couple steps back.
Interesting. That's an interesting point. So I think you may have mentioned this, but I guess then really what is the goal and the actual benefit from the healthcare industry in being resilient?
So a lot of it really does come down to the patients, you know, and you were talking in the very beginning about how this is maybe, you know, seen to be kind of like a separate parallel aspect to patient care. And I honestly see it as entwined. You know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that we as a healthcare system produce in the U.S. 8.5% of our greenhouse gas emissions. And those greenhouse gas emissions and the resultant fossil fuel pollutants, the particulate matter 2.5 and the ozone and sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, all of these things that as pulmonologists, you're all very, very well acquainted. All of these impacts have direct effects on our patients. So I see our efforts in sustainability as a direct preventive health measure to try to go upstream to keep our patients healthier and to keep populations healthier. In terms of resilience, again, this is a matter of being able to treat our patients, being able to keep our doors open when patients need us the very most.
Great. So my next question, maybe you've touched on a little bit as well, but we're going to turn to sustainability. And I understand this can be viewed as the healthcare industry trying to balance environmental, social, and economic needs in delivery of their healthcare while still being aware of the needed resilience you mentioned already. Can you speak to what this balancing means and areas of focus for the healthcare industry at this point in time?
Yeah. So, you know, I think maybe just to step back and do some basics in terms of sustainability. You know, when we're thinking about sustainability, we often talk about three scopes of emissions, scope one, scope two, and scope three. So scope one emissions are those emissions that are coming right from your healthcare center. So that might be anesthetic gases. It might be ambulances. Scope two is your purchased electricity. And scope three is everything else. That means your medications, all that PPE from COVID, research, investments, transportation. And so as you can imagine, scope three is a big chunk of a hospital's emissions. So as we're trying to tackle all of those, we need to think about where the emissions are coming from and where our immediate scope of influence can actually affect change. And so very often, scope one or maybe scope two are where we'll hone in on first, because those are some aspects that we can directly impact. So if we talk about scope one, for example, with anesthetic gases, I'll use desflurane as an example, because desflurane is a potent greenhouse gas. We often don't think about it as that, but our anesthesia colleagues have actually been way ahead of us on this. They've been doing research in this field for a while. So desflurane is about 2,540 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And it's also more expensive. So a case of desflurane, and, you know, I'm not a supply chain expert, but it costs about a little upwards of $13 a case, whereas sevoflurane, which is, you know, it's not fabulous. It's about 140 times more potent than carbon dioxide, but is about 60 cents. So orders of magnitude difference. And health systems that have made that change and have tried to de-emphasize desflurane in favor of IV anesthetics have saved a lot of money and have not experienced any adverse patient outcomes. So like Seattle Children's Hospital, for example, saved about $175,000 annually by removing desflurane, unless it was specifically requested. And they also cut down on their nitrous oxide flows, because nitrous oxide is also about 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So these are your kind of your win-win situations where you can save a health system money and you're also decreasing the environmental output. So you really look for those win-win situations. We also don't need to reframe a lot of the value proposition. So we traditionally will think about value just in terms of outcomes over costs. And we need to broaden that. We need to think about outcomes for the patient that we're treating, but also for populations. And we need to expand cost so that it's the planet and its populations and its people. It's all of those things put together. So I think just, you know, broadening our lens really changes the conversation.
I've heard the term carbon footprint a lot, and some industries actually measure that and determine whether or not they can send people on trips and use airlines if they've reached a certain limit. Do you see healthcare systems looking at things like the carbon footprint, or at least putting it in that term?
And a lot already have. And, you know, I love that you mentioned the travel aspect, because, you know, that is something that it's such an easy way because air travel is so carbon intensive. It's a very easy way for us to cut down on our carbon footprint. And there have been some great studies that have modeled trying to prioritize virtual meetings. We do the same thing with telehealth too, though. So, you know, if we can offer telehealth to our patients, there have been some really interesting studies. I think there was a study out of California, I believe, that was saying that it saves patients on average about $11 or $12 in terms of their travel. But then, of course, there's a carbon savings and there's also a time savings. So, you know, again, looking at these win-win situations. So that's really where we want to prioritize.
During my introduction of you, you sound like you're fairly well involved from an advocacy standpoint and policy standpoint. Do you feel that this is something that much of the healthcare industry is already addressing at this point, or are there gaps, or are there certain learnings that we can try to get to, mainly the business people, the administrators of some of these organizations?
Yeah, you know, I think highlighting those positive ROIs, those return on investments, where it's like a no-brainer, and then you can scaffold. So that you start with things like changing out LED light bulbs and maybe you switching to plant-based meals. There was a New York City did this, and they saved about 60 cents per meal, and there was a greater than 90% patient satisfaction. So finding, again, these win-win situations, I think can really help those institutions that may be in the pre-contemplative stage.
Right.
And certainly there's been a lot of support from organizations like the Joint Commission, which has rolled out a sustainability certification. And there are many health systems that are taking advantage of that. Practice Green Health will help organizations along that road as well. So I think it's just, you know, it's something that people, it's new for a lot of people. So
right.
They have to get used to this idea. But once they see, I think, the cost savings, it will be much easier to enact. There's some inertia in medicine in general. You know,
right,
this is why
right.
It takes 15 years for our best practice to get implemented.
Absolutely right. Guidelines stay on the shelf for so many years. Yeah. So this is a big topic. Is there anything particular that we didn't hit upon that you'd like to mention before we close?
Oh, goodness. I would love to stay here. So, you know, I will refer everyone to a report that we did in the state of New Jersey through the American College of Physicians. We had pulled together a task force. It was called the SITE report. It's the Sustainable Initiatives to Guide Healthcare Transformation. Mm-hmm. And so I had structured 13 different subsections where we went through all of the different potential avenues, whether it's greening the OR or water reduction, waste reduction, what can you do with energy and power purchase agreements and construction, transportation. There's so much when you peel back the layers to it. So I would certainly refer people there. It's on the ACP New Jersey website. And if people are interested, you know, just start by doing something. Again, you know, it might not feel huge. It might even start by educating your patients mm-hmm. on the impacts of climate change and poor air quality and extreme heat. Right now, I talk to all of my patients about downloading an air quality app and the OSHA NIOSHA for extreme heat. And I counsel my patients about this mm-hmm. because, you know, heat exacerbates a lot of chronic respiratory diseases and sleep disordered breathing, and is associated with pneumonias and of course all of the downstream impacts of pollutants. Mm-hmm. So I think that talking to your patients about this is also incredibly, incredibly valuable and a great jumping off point.
I recently spoke to someone about nutrition, and I asked them about what medical schools are teaching about nutrition these days, and probably woefully less than they should. And I'll ask you the same thing about sustainability and resilience. Are people in medical school hearing about this at a point where they can start making up their minds about what they can do?
Yes. So I want to go back to the nutrition aspect too.
Okay.
The whole section on plant-based nutrition, because you know that's something else that we really need to prioritize for the health of our patients and our planet. I think that there's been increasing efforts now to include more nutrition. There was recently a task force pulled together by ACGME and I believe AAMC to focus on including more nutrition. And a lot of that comes back to, you know, getting away from animal-based sources of protein. In terms of climate health and sustainability, the AAMC now has climate health as a keyword. And the National Academy of Medicine has been leading a coalition to integrate more climate health within medical school education. There's been a lot of discussion across the continuum from UME, GME to CME. So, and I think with the backing of a lot of these national organizations, we do see that momentum. There was a report that came out of AMC that suggested, I think it was from 2019 up to 2023, we increased the amount of medical schools delivering climate health education from about 20 to about, I say about 60. So we made a big jump just in a few years because people are seeing the impacts.
Well, you certainly have given us a great perspective on this whole topic. I want to thank you for your time today and your expertise. There's no question that it's there. To our listeners, thank you. And if you want to hear more regarding all things respiratory related, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. So please be sure to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform. And visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. And until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.